Wait for a little blue light.
There we go.
Okay. Welcome to our meeting today for the House Subcommittee on Higher Ed. Good to have you all here. We've got a lot of work we're going to try to get done today, so we're going to get started as close to being on time as we can. And I'm going to ask you to be as succinct as you can in your testimony. We have a lot of folks to talk to, some different bills today, so if I prod you along, it's not because I'm trying to be rude, but we're just trying to get our work done today. So with that, I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2297, and I'd like to call Timothy Hogan to the stand. Is he in the House?
Co-Chair Johnson and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to speak today. My name is Tyler Hogan. I'm a student at Oregon State University and also a member of the Board of Directors for Oregon Student Association. OSA represents over 100,000 students in public community colleges and universities across the state. I'm here today to speak in opposition to House Bill 2297. There are also over 100 students from public community colleges and public universities in the state of Oregon that are here today in this building in opposition to House Bill 2297, as well as in support in the Senate side for tuition equity. The Oregon Student Association voted to oppose this bill for two distinct reasons. The first and most important part of our concern is based upon the current state of the Oregon Opportunity Grant. It is projected that 319,600 students will qualify for the Oregon Opportunity Grant in the 2011-2013 biennium. Yet even with Governor Kitzhoffer's recommended increase to the grant, only 80,000 of these 316,900 students will actually receive an award. In the last 2 years, the Oregon Student Assistance Commission has seen a 15% increase in applicants for private scholarships, and only 1/4 of the students who apply for private funds actually receive an award. Students in our public community colleges and public universities are starving for the Oregon Opportunity Grant, and we should use those dollars to invest in our public institutions. The Oregon Opportunity Grant is our only need-based aid program in Oregon. We already have early cutoff dates, harsh requirements, and limited funding. Please don't dilute the pool any further by allotting financial aid dollars to institutions that profit off of those seeking higher education. Our second concern is the larger picture of whether or not the Oregon Opportunity Grant should be going to for-profit institutions. This is part of a much larger debate. For-profit schools are graduating students with considerably more debt than public or independent colleges. There are currently questions about the level of debt, the quality, and the merit of such institutions. This brings us back to the point that the Oregon Opportunity Grant is severely underfunded, and we have much bigger questions to answer before we entertain the idea of additional recipients. Thank you for considering our opposition, and please vote no on House Bill 2297.
Thank you for your testimony. There are other people that testify on this bill as well. Is it Angel Christensen?
Are there any questions?
Any questions of our witness?
No.
Okay.
Way down here in the balcony.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Harker.
thank you, Mr. Chair.
You referenced the level of debt for students going through some of these schools, and I was wonder if you would expand on that, because I haven't seen figures on that. Have you actually seen figures and have recall of any of them right now?
I can't recall any of them right now. I know one of the things that we've really focused on is the fact that, you know, just last week in the Senate, there's a conversation about the merit of for-profit institutions with a professor from Portland State University. We've seen a lot of specials, and there's a lot of research going on, even in the federal government, about the merit and quality of these for-profit institutions. And so that's part of the thing that we've been discussing is, as OSA, we're here to represent public community colleges and public universities, and we're only looking at, you know, some of the limited information we have. And so when you're talking about the debt levels, I don't have statistics right now, for the main reason being that there's still a lot of research that needs to go into this conversation and this discussion.
Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm assuming that students at for-profit universities, and I have friends there, are not allowed to be part of your association, and if so, why not?
there's a few reasons. The first part is that that's part of the stipulations that we're only representing public universities as well as public community colleges. That's part of our mission statement for the Oregon Student Association, as well as some of the restrictions go into the student governments and having control of your student fees while you're at those the university or community college.
I'll just have a follow-up. In a perfect world, if there were adequate resources to go around for scholarships, would you guys feel differently about the position that you're taking now?
In a perfect world, I would probably assume so, if there were adequate resources to fund all of higher education the way that we would like to see it, but that's unfortunately not our case.
So your opposition to the for-profits is conditional, is that correct?
I don't know if I can answer that on behalf of the entire organization, because that's something that we'd have to discuss. As of right now, we're in definite opposition. Whether or not that's conditional or not is a conversation we'll have to have later.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you
for testimony. Is it Angel Christensen? Here she comes. If I get these names wrong, forgive me.
Chair Johnson, and members of the committee, my name is Angel Christensen. I'm from Heald College, and I support the Oregon Opportunity Grant. I've been going to Heald for, well, I'm almost done, for 18 months, and I think it would really help out. For me, I'm a single parent of two children. It would lower my tuition cost. It would help me enormously of everything. Would help me big time with cost of living, gas, you know, without having a job. It would help with children, child care. I don't know. I think it would be a great thing if it could be passed.
Great. Representative Hoyle?
Hi, could you tell us what you're studying and what job you're hoping to get? Because I think that's part of what we want to look at is what's the difference between why are you going to this school and not community college?
Chair Johnson, Representative Hoyle, I am going to be a medical assistant. Mm-hmm. I have looked at other colleges. I actually, back in 2006, went to Cambridge College, and at that point in time, I couldn't afford it. Later on in the years, I was able to go back to school. I had a job at the time. And I chose Heald, according to all the other, basically from all the other schools, because it fit my schedule. They worked with me. Everything was perfect. It is perfect. I can go in evening. I can go in any time, and they're always there. Job placements there for me.
I would just ask your choice of Heald over a community college. I'm just wondering. Why that? Just through my own information, you made that choice. I'm wondering what led to that decision.
Well, Chair Johnson, the reason why I chose that is because at PCC there was a waiting list.
Okay.
And at that time, I was ready. I didn't want to have me put on a waiting list and then later on change my mind and never go to college. And with Heald, there was not a waiting list. They brought me in when I was ready.
Thanks. I appreciate that. Any other further questions? Thank you. Molly Webb.
Chair Johnson, representatives, thank you for having me today. My name is Molly Webb. I go to Heald College. I'm in the medical assisting program. I chose Heald College because I looked at Mount Hood Community College, PCC. They were completely full or had a wait list. I am on my own. I have to support myself and was eager to get into a medical assisting program. I started to look around. I discovered Heald College. And with all that they have to offer, I feel like I'm in the right place, the exact place I need to be. They have a great support system, job placement. Everything is all contained in one. We're all in the same program together. We are, we don't get lost through the cracks and it's fast, and I need to get out, and I need to make money to support myself.
Mm. Great, appreciate that. Questions? Thank you, appreciate it. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Erica Dahl, please.
You have to forgive me. I'm a little nervous.
We're scary people.
Yeah.
Some more scary than others.
As stated, my name is Erica Dahl. I'm going to actually be speaking in favor of House Bill 2297. I'm actually a nursing student studying to be a registered nurse at ITT Technical Institute. And I just want to give you...
We're not really scary.
I know.
Thanks.
Just a little bit of my background and why...
Your time.
I'd like to say that being a nurse has actually been my life's ambition, and I worked tirelessly through high school to ensure that I was going to achieve this dream, but that actually wasn't the case. I went off to college right after high school to study political science, of all things.
Hey.
So
we need more.
I think right now I'd actually rather be on your side. I took a detour my junior year of college and married a military man. Mm-hmm. And it was during this time that I actually decided that nursing was for me. While my husband was deployed overseas with the Navy, I got to be the labor coach for a fellow Navy wife. Mm-hmm. And being there in that moment and realizing that the reason I liked political science so much was because I wanted to help and serve people. And nursing would give me that that same feeling and that same fulfillment. And let's face it, the pay is not all bad either. So I'd like to say that I was able to jump right in and start taking nursing classes, but life had other plans for me. So I spent the next few years working and raising three children and helping my husband get through college after the military and trying to figure out how I could afford to do all this and still have the time and money to go to nursing school. And I knew that, you know, being a mother and the spouse of a veteran, that I would receive some financial support, but was it going to be enough? So during this time, we were actually living in the state of Ohio. My husband's a native Oregonian, and we always had ambitions of coming back out here, but again, life just takes you down different paths, and you don't know what you're able to do. So I was in the banking industry, and the economy in Ohio was suffering greatly, so I lost my job in banking, and I decided that that was as good a time as any to, you know, try to pursue this dream of nursing, and I explored colleges in Ohio, and in the end, that just wasn't the best path for my family and I. My in-laws, who live in the Gorge, had made me an offer. If I was serious about nursing school, they would take my husband and I and our three children and put the seven of us in a three-bedroom ranch so that I could afford to go to college and go to nursing school and have some of the financial burden lifted. So we made the sacrifice, and we left the family and the only life my children had ever known and came here to the Northwest. My husband was excited, obviously, but it was a big step for us. And, you know, I'd love to say that right as soon as we got out here, I jumped right into nursing school, but I don't know if any of you are aware how difficult it actually is to get into nursing school. In May of 2009, right after the same month we moved here, I started taking classes at Columbia Gorge Community College because you have to have so many prerequisites to get into a nursing program. And so that I was hoping that by the fall of 2010, I would be able to start nursing at Columbia Gorge Community College. Well, I sent applications to them, PCC, and also Clackamas Community College. And, you know, after applying to three schools and spending well over $200 on just application fees, my 3.6 grade point average made my mom and dad real happy, but it wasn't enough to get me into a nursing program. I actually got my final rejection letter on Mother's Day of last year. And so I decided, you know what, I can either sit here and, you know, be upset about it, or I can take action. And So I decided to look into other options, you know, to become an LPN and then move on to RN or other programs like that. So I actually applied to Pioneer Pacific College and Concord Career College and was accepted into their programs, but then I found ITT. And they were just starting a new RN program, and I knew the cost was going to be a little much, but, you know, I wasn't aware that they offered this. I always thought ITT was that college on TV that offers, you know, criminal justice and career computer careers. So I thought, I'm going to take the time and look into this. And I sat in on an informational session, and that's when they explained to me the school's philosophy and the structure of their program. And it's a school who they emphasized, probably 20 times in just that informational session, they are focused on student success, and they take a very hands-on approach to nursing, which was something that I needed. And they also, you know, it's a two-year program. When they say 2 years, that's just flat 2 years. It's not 2 years of prerequisites and then 2 years. I'm getting ready to turn 30 on Sunday, so life was passing me by, and I really just wanted to, you know, take the bull by the horns and get into this. You know, I'm aware that there are state grants and tuition assistance programs that aren't available to students like me who attend private for-profit colleges, when that was the best option for me at the time. Many of the classmates that I am with every day are in the same boat as me. We've been working for years to make a better life for ourselves, for our family, in a career that makes us feel happy and fulfilled. And I just wish I could convey to you the huge weight that is lifted off of a person when they are able to get into a nursing program, or any college program for that matter. It feels like you can finally begin the rest of your life. Like, up until then, you were sitting in this holding pattern, waiting for the next phase of your life to start. ITT gave me that opportunity and the chance to start the rest of my life. And there's no greater feeling than when my kids at school introduce me as, this is my mom, she's a nurse. So I urge Oregon to step up to the plate and extend these same opportunities to students of private career colleges that they extend to all other college students. So I'd be happy to answer any of your questions now that I've calmed down a little.
Well, my first question is, whereabouts in the gorge are you living?
We are in the Hood River area.
Well, it's an honor to have you as a constituent.
Thank you very much.
My other comments would be, you and I, besides living in the same county and area, have a lot of common denominators. My wife's been an RN for 30 years, and I have a son that's deployed in Iraq.
So, thank you. It's hard.
I appreciate you.
I did it for a lot of years, having my husband gone.
My other question I would have is, as you looked at the criteria, I guess, or actually the academics of the nursing program at Mount Hood or Columbia Gorge versus what you're now experiencing at ITT, do you have any comments about how their curriculum was structured and so forth?
From what I've understood, and granted, when you're not accepted into the program, you don't get a full idea. I know that I volunteer at the hospital in Hood River, in the birth center, and I do see a lot of nursing students come through there, and I think there's a lot of parallels between the programs, and that's why I guess I just don't understand, you know, why it is harder for us, because, and I can tell you that I paid tuition at Columbia Gorge and I'm paying tuition at ITT, and those of us at the private for-profit colleges need assistance, I was going to say just as much as anyone, but sometimes a little more. You know, we're not the ones getting overage checks and things like that. We, most of us, do come out still owing some on top of our student loans. And that's hard. I know that I'll be paying student loans until my oldest child is ready to go to college. And that's a little overwhelming because I'll have three of them in college at the same time. So we all do clinicals just the same. We all come out ready to sit for our boards and obtain an Oregon State nursing license. You know, we all want to fight for the same jobs in Oregon. And there's not a huge difference between the programs, except, you know, the nice thing with the private career colleges, a lot of times they're able to admit students. Oh, ITT admits students four times per year. When I applied to Columbia Gorge, it was 24 students once a year. And that makes a big difference for those of us. I think there's only two people in the class who
are not over the age of 23. So, I mean, most of us are working and taking care of families.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your testimony, and congratulations.
Thank you.
I know you're not done, but I have no doubt that you will complete. Oftentimes I've heard in similar committees concerns about the trade schools in particular and the private career schools not delivering on promises.
Mm-hmm.
They said they'd do this, and I've drilled down many times, and I've yet to find the instances where that has actually occurred.
Okay.
So I know you're not finished yet, and there were probably discussions about placement and those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
You come out with a nursing degree, you're going to get placed. I mean, there's a high demand for nurses, so that's great. I'm very excited for you. So have there been some disappointments along the process? Have there been some commitments made that you didn't feel were met? Can you talk to us about that process? Or
yes.
Has it been great?
Chair Johnson, Representative Springer.
That's okay.
We just finished up our second quarter this week with finals. Mm-hmm. So as of right now, and we are a new program, I mean, we were cohort two to begin. So I'd let you know, we have yet to come across any speed bumps that we weren't expecting. Right now they're ironing out the program. But not once have I been concerned that when I come out, I'm going to be in a worse place than anyone else. You know, we were told ahead of time what to expect as far as classes, as far as clinicals. We've also just recently taken on a new director who is taking the program in a wonderful direction. And, you know, from day one, they set us up with career services. You go in and you, at any time, can receive assistance writing a resume, doing interview prep. Wayne, our director of the school, is actually always available. We, you know, you just pop your head in, and any questions, concerns you have, they are always available to help you out with any problems that you're having. And so far, I'm loving it.
Very good.
Thank you.
Rep. Parker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thanks for the testimony. I'm wondering about the instructors, and we do need more nurses. Everyone coming out with who is a qualified nurse is most likely going to find employment and in an area where we need those bodies and skills, right? I also know that we face a shortage of instructors for nursing programs across the country.
Mm-hmm.
Who are the instructors and the designers of the program at your institution?
Okay, Chair Johnson, Representative Harker. We, our new director, her name is Eileen Gottsfeld, and she comes to us originally from the state of New York, loves the Pacific Northwest, so she came up here. She has a background as a pediatric nurse practitioner, so she just an all-around knowledgeable nurse. I know that a few times she's had to step in when instructors have been ill and teach our classes, and the knowledge that she brings and the experience that she provides during our instruction is just invaluable. So far, we have had two other instructors, Cheryl Pippin, who is also a nurse practitioner down, I believe, in the Beaverton area, and Irene Sweeney, who actually spent most of her career down in the state of Arizona, but again, moved to the state of Oregon because they liked the area, and she spent a lot of her time actually working on Indian reservations, and so she's able to give us the view of working in a hospital, but also working with different cultures, which is something that we face a lot in this state. It's very diverse. So, you know, we have found that aside from giving us, you know, the by-the-book instruction, they have also been able, it's nice to get that hands-on, this is my experience, and, you know, things that they can't teach you in a book. So I do not have the name of my instructor for next quarter. I have met her, and you're going to have to excuse me because I do not know her name. But, again, and they are looking for more instructors and have approached us students because a lot of my fellow students do work in the medical field already as nursing assistants. Anyone that they know that may be interested in helping out and teaching, and we find that a lot with nurses who are getting ready to retire, but you know, they'd rather just step into the educational side of things.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony today.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to do something a little bit different now. We have a representative here that's going to testify to another bill that's on our plate today. So what I'm going to do is...
Mr. Chair, might I speak on this one also?
Certainly. Please, Representative Huffman, please weigh in.
I couldn't resist. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. John Huffman, State Rep for District 59. Out of the Dalles, lost to Hood River again. Sorry about that. The articulate and compelling testimony before me would be very difficult to follow, but there were a couple of things that have been burning issues with me. Being on the House Education Committee for over 3.5 years, being on the Oregon Workforce Investment Board for the same amount of time, working on workforce issues in healthcare and other industries in Oregon, have been well aware of the need for nurses and many other positions throughout the state. Also being familiar with Governor Kulongoski's goal of 40-40-20 in our, you know, trying to get people degreed up. You know, I've always been an advocate for career colleges, knowing that if there are things people know about me, it's I'm very pro-community college, and I'm very supportive of getting people skilled up and degreed up. But if our community colleges can't handle the demand that the industry is placing on it, then we need to be open to alternatives. And I think I have seen that and found it in the private career colleges, and I think the testimony before us has been very encouraging in that direction. And I've always been supportive, as money is available, to expand the opportunity grant to students that want to go to the private career colleges also. If our goal is to skill people up and to fill the nursing vacancies, I've always had to ask myself, why do I care where they get educated if they meet our goal? So anyway, I will shut up on that. But I just one other thing that came up. I did find out recently, now having all of those credentials I mentioned, 3.5 years on the House Ed Committee and the Oregon Workforce Investment Board, and working on nursing issues, I didn't realize, being the father of Sarah, that is enrolled at Chemeketa, working on trying to get into Chemeketa's nursing program, I didn't realize that with Oregon Community Colleges, there were actually two different tracks in the nursing program. One is the ladder, which is Columbia Gorge Community College's two-year contained program for the two-year RN degree, where all of your prereqs and then your, you know, all your lab work and everything's contained in the program. Chemeketa is the different program, and it's, I can't remember the name of it. It's, thank you. I knew if I turned it on, where you do your prereqs, and then you enroll into the one-year nursing program. I think it's a balance of 1 year where you do your labs and whatnot. And Sarah didn't find that out until she was already through with a lot of her prereqs, and now next year she'll be looking at hoping to get one of those few slots into the nursing program. So I just wanted to throw that out. I didn't know if everybody on the committee understood that even in our community colleges we have different approaches to the two-year RN degree. So thank you very much.
Okay, with that, what I'm going to do is temporarily gavel to a close this hearing on House Bill 2297, and I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 3123, and I'd like to call back Representative Huffman to introduce this bill to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. John Huffman, State Rep for District 59. Officially, Wasco, Sherman, Gillum, Wheeler, Grant, Jefferson, and parts of Northern Deschutes, Clackamas, and Marion counties. House Bill 3123 is a symptom of a problem that we've had in the legislature the last couple of years with dealing with the recession, shortfalls in revenue. It was determined that by the co-chairs of Ways and Means predominantly, although I'm not going to just point fingers there. I think all of us are to blame to a certain extent, but we've looked at balancing budgets over the last couple of biennia by looking in places that I think we shouldn't have been looking. One of those was $1.8 million from the Cultural Trust. There was $3.5 million from 911 fees, and one of those fund raids, if you will, fund sweeps, was private college tuition set-aside funds, a pot of money that is set aside to protect student tuition. You know, we've had a concern that since private colleges collect student tuition, and in the past maybe one of them has gone bankrupt, and those students maybe lost their money, you know, this fund was set aside. It's set up by statute that the colleges put a certain percent of the tuition aside in a fund, and last year, I think it was $1 million was swept out of that fund, which really affects the students. And fortunately, we don't hear it happening often, but if one of the private colleges were to file bankruptcy, it could really be detrimental to the security of the students' tuitions that had been paid in. And that's what this fund is for. And so it's an attempt to try to put a little further protection on yet another account that we don't think is appropriate, I don't think is appropriate, for the legislature to be sweeping funds out of. And that's my tee up, and I do believe I have some folks behind me that are going to get maybe just a tad bit deeper into the weeds on it. But thank you for your time.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions for the rep? Representative Harker.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Real briefly, we're inserting the word trust in it. Are you satisfied that if these changes are made, it would be adequate protection?
Okay.
So that there wouldn't be a repeat performance?
Mr. Chair, co-chairs, and Representative Harker, I think it's a good step toward protecting this money. I've been around here over 3.5 years, and I have brought up concerns in Ways and Means subcommittees that I have sat on, and the co-chairs have in the past looked at me and said, so sue us. You know, I think it's pretty cavalier attitude on our parts when we should be protecting funds like this to say, well, watch me, we're going to sweep the money anyway. We've had some difficult times, had to make some difficult decisions, and I don't mean to make light of those. And I'm not saying there was $1 million somewhere else we could have gotten. I think there were alternatives, and I think it was egregious that we went to pots of money like this to balance the budget.
Thank you, Representative. Appreciate it. Gina Wickstrom, would you like to come forward and talk about this?
Good afternoon. Co-chairs, members of the committee, I'm Gina Wickstrom, Executive Director of the Northwest Career Colleges Federation. We are here today in support of House Bill 3123, and we want to thank Representative Huffman for his support on this bill. He's done an excellent job in describing to you what happened last year, the $1 million sweep out of a fund, bring it down to about half of what it was. The fund is about 15 years old, and it was created in statute then as kind of a self-insurance fund, funded totally by 10-year contributions by the private career colleges licensed by the Department of Education. So it's taken a long time to get that fund up to a little over $2 million. And while we understand the state is in dire straits for funds, this fund is set up specifically for the purpose of refunding prepaid unearned tuition in the unlikely and unfortunate event of a school closure. So we think that removing $1 million from that fund with a specific purpose is wrong, and we hope that by passing this bill and enacting it, that the next time there's a need for a sweep from accounts, that it moves this way, goes around the tuition protection fund, and then moves on. So we certainly ask for your support in House Bill 3123. Thank you.
Thank you. Rep. Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your testimony. One of the questions I have, and I certainly like this idea, I'm one of the co-sponsors of the bill, but one of the questions that I'm kind of wrestling with is, how often are the funds accessed? I can't believe it's very often, but how often are the funds accessed, assuming they have been? And how is that accessed? I mean, if you lose X amount of dollars in tuition, do you get equal dollars back, or do you get a portion? So could you help me understand that?
We happen to have in the audience Teresa Green, who is the administrator of the Tuition Protection Fund through the Department of Education, but I will attempt to address your question. First of all, regarding closures, occasionally there are closures. I asked that exact question of the department. How much money has been paid out in the last 5 years, and who were the schools that closed that withdrew that, and how much money was paid to the students? Of course, I don't have those exact numbers, but there was one school that closed, the modeling school, that had been questionable for quite some time on their licensing, and there was a small amount of money paid out to those students to refund them for tuition that they had paid for education they had not received. So, no, in answer to your question, it does not happen often, thank goodness, or the fund would be considerably smaller. But it is set up to protect the students, and we are very supportive of that. Thank you.
Question, Representative Harker?
She took the words right out of my mouth. I'm set.
Representative Denbrough.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry, I was testifying in another hearing. Rep. Huffman covered this, but going back to Rep. Springer's question about what is reimbursed to the students, are they reimbursed just the amount of the tuition for the uncompleted part of their program, or are they reimbursed entirely for what they paid? You know, let's say, for example, that the students in the modeling school were able to have 9 months of modeling and they had signed up for 12 months. Do they get the full 12 months back as a tuition reimbursement?
Mr. Chair, Representative Denbrough, it's my understanding that the calculation is based upon the amount of education that they paid for that they didn't get. So if they paid $5,000 in tuition to become a model, and the school closed after the student was in there a month, that they would have a prorated amount that they paid that they did not receive, that it is not retroactive to the students educational commencement. And again, Teresa Green may correct me on that, but that's my understanding.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the assumption, if I could follow up.
Yes, sir.
So the assumption is that they could, I mean, ideally what we want to have happen is that they could take the 9 months of instruction, you know, of knowledge that they've gained, mm-hmm. transfer to another modeling school, and then not have to start from scratch, but, you know, would just have maybe, you know, a little bit of work left to do. Do you know, and so my question is, do you know if that's actually how it plays out, or how it has played out?
Mr. Chair, Representative Denbrough, in my experience, and I've been doing this for 20 years, so there's a little bit of experience back there, that a number of years ago, and I'm going back maybe 10 years ago, there was a school that had a large number of students that did cease operations, and that they received their tuition repayments, and that there were schools then that stood ready to assist them with completing their education and gave them prior learning assessment and credit for what they've already earned, so that they weren't double paying for what occurred at the school. Did that answer your question?
I appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, I think that's what we would hope the fund would do.
Absolutely.
You know,
I agree.
That it would not just repay the, you know, whatever they missed, but would kind of make them whole, as it were.
Right.
And great. I just want to say it's great to see you here, Gina. We've worked a lot together.
Thank you.
This is a bill I support. I you know, want to make sure that the students in these programs are protected. Thank you.
I absolutely agree, and we hope that you all support the bill, because it is about the students.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
One more person to testify on this is Siri Dixon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Representative Johnson and representatives. My name is Siri Dixon. I represent Everest Institute Tigard location, and we actually pay into this fund. We paid about $51,000 into this fund within the last 8 years, and we are in full support of this bill, House Bill 3123, and again, it is a protection for our students, and so that is the key here, and the bottom line is it's a protection for our students. We're private businesses, and we want to ensure that protection, and so again, I thank Representative Huffman for putting this bill forward because it is a key protection for our students if something were to happen to the schools that facilitate their education. So thank you for your time today, and if you have any questions, I'm open to those.
Questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. Appreciate that. It does sound like a fairly common sense solution, and you know, sometimes that's hard to come by, but so we thank you all for your offerings, and with that, we're going to gavel to Kevin Lambert. I'm sorry. Did I miss Kevin Lambert? I'm sorry.
Good afternoon. Thank you for this time. My name is Kevin Lambert, and I'm a five-year member of the private career school. I'm a public member for the private career schools here for the state of Oregon. I've been in the school business for 30 years, and just want to say I'm really about supporting the students, and the money that's set aside for protecting them really truly needs to be protected. And for the state to move it to the general fund is leaving the students at risk for the bad schools when they do come along. But I also want to say, in general, the private career schools do an excellent, excellent job of training. And just a comment. So I'll keep it brief, as you requested. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Comments?
Seeing on. Oh, Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a very brief commentary, quite frankly, no question. I just think it's kind of ironic that the legislature, and I was part of it, the legislature at the time, sweeping funds when we're in a recession, when we're struggling financially, it would seem to me to be the very time the money would be needed most for schools struggling is the very time that the money is disappearing. And I just find a bit of an irony in that. It doesn't make anybody the bad guy.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Anybody else here to testify on behalf of House Bill 3123? With that, we'll gavel that hearing closed, and I'll reopen the hearing then on House Bill 2297. And Gina, would you like to come talk to 2297, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Gina Wickstrom. I'm the Executive Director of the Northwest Career Colleges Federation, here before you today to express sincere support of House Bill 2297. I have spoken with many of you over the years about the equity issue associated with the opportunity grant that otherwise eligible Oregonians attending either a community college, a public university, or a private university would be eligible for the program. Yet because a private career college is the exact fit for what they want out of their education and their career, they are deemed ineligible for that assistance. We truly believe that the opportunity grant should be about funding students and not entitlements to institutions. And I know I have said that before you many times before, but I continue to feel very strongly that our students deserve the assistance as Oregonians of the opportunity grant to assist them with the issues you heard about today, which is child care and the educational costs of getting to school. We also heard a comment about a concern about student loan indebtedness. And I would like to offer to you that perhaps if the private career college students were able to access the opportunity grant for those that were eligible, perhaps their student loan indebtedness would not be at the level of concerns voiced earlier. I would also like to comment on one of the questions that was raised today about the student loan indebtedness for students attending our colleges. We find that our student loan indebtedness is equal to some of the four-year private colleges. Certainly it's not as much as the students attending the community colleges because our tuitions are not subsidized. So consequently, it's a full commitment by the students to pay our tuition. I will note that if you'd like to go on the CFM website, There is information on there about individual sectors' indebtedness, and you can take a look at that as well. So I do urge you to support equalizing the Oregon Opportunity Grant so that the students that attend the career colleges are able to access that as Oregonians. And I do know that these are very tough times in the state of Oregon, and that money is an issue. And that is exactly why I believe that we should embrace bringing these students into the Opportunity Grant. Isn't it about a return on investment for the good people of Oregon, that you take the taxpayers' dollars and they should expect some kind of return on that investment? And I truly believe that the career colleges stand ready to bring forward to you that level of commitment, to show to you that that small investment by the state of Oregon will come back to the state many times over through the students that go through our colleges and secure employment in the state of Oregon. Thank you very much, and I'm here to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm reading the statute here, and I see that a qualified student means a resident.
Correct.
And I haven't read it fully yet, but I'm wondering if there's a distinction between an in-state tuition resident or out-of-state tuition resident. I'm assuming that to be a qualified student in the Oregon University public system, you need to be an in-state person paying in-state tuition in order to qualify for the Oregon Opportunity Grant. If my assumption is correct, how does that play out to the for-profit institutions?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lindsay, the career colleges would be required to comply with all residency, disbursement, operation, administrative requirements that are currently in place for the Opportunity Grant. A resident would be defined exactly as it is in statute for the students that attend our colleges as well. And a resident is whatever that is to define an Oregon resident.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up on that, I think the rules for the Oregon Opportunity Grant require you to have graduated from an Oregon high school or the equivalent. So whether you're going to a private nonprofit or a public school, it only applies to those who have graduated from Oregon high schools. Jen, one of the concerns that I've heard about the bill is that, in a for-profit context, having access to the Opportunity Grant is going to encourage the colleges to increase their tuition, thereby increase their profit margin, knowing that the students will be able to afford it because they'll now have access to state money. Could you respond to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Embrough, let me address that. In recognition of the fact that the majority of students that attend our colleges probably would not be eligible for the Opportunity Grant, for an institution to raise the tuition on all of their students for a minority group of students that would potentially get an element of Opportunity Grant would be absolutely bad business. And so I cannot imagine that a school would just choose to raise their tuition on all of their programs by the chance that some student may be eligible for Opportunity Grant. It makes no sense to me at all.
Let me just follow up if I could. So why would most of the students not be eligible? Most of the students are, I think, low income who are going to career schools, for-profit universities.
Mr. Chair, 61% of the students in our accredited colleges are Pell Grant eligible. Those are poor students. So you have to assume that those students may be eligible for Opportunity Grant. It's my understanding, though, that Opportunity Grant is doled out in a fair process, and that the career college students would get their fair share, if you will. So that it's not like all of a sudden tons of the Opportunity Grant becomes available to career colleges, so they go out and they start marketing differently. It's an issue of equity. If they are needy and poor students and they're Oregonians, it seems to me that they should be eligible for that regardless of what institution they choose to attend. And so I don't quite know how to say that maybe they would get more, but they would get their fair share and it would be representative of their student body.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you all.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Hoyle had a question.
Didn't mean to overlook you.
It's because I'm so quiet and shy and retiring.
Demure.
Demure. Yeah. Thank you very much for your testimony. My question is, as you mentioned, we are in very tough economic times, in a desperate budget situation with a $3.5 billion budget deficit that we have to balance. And my question is, you know, before I even look at should we or shouldn't we change how we disperse the Oregon Opportunity Grant, for me to make a decision that then would say, yes, I think this policy is good, and send it down to Ways and Means, where they already don't have enough funds to cover what they need, and we already don't have enough money within the Opportunity Grant process to cover the students that already exist. Why would it make sense for us to do this now when we don't have the funds for the existing student population?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoyle, I think it's a very difficult decision for you folks that are elected to represent the citizens of Oregon. It is, as I've talked about, an issue of equity. And I think it would be very difficult for an elected official to look at a student who is attending Willamette University, who is eligible for the Opportunity Grant and is majoring in French philosophy, and say you're eligible for the Opportunity Grant because we think that that degree will be of great value to the state of Oregon, and to look at one of our students sitting back here who has made the decision to change their life and with passion go into a field of nursing or a medical assisting and say, we're very sorry, Madam Oregonian, you are not worthy of that. We just don't have the money. I've been coming down here for 5 years now, and for 5 years I've heard we don't have the money. And I just don't see how we can continue to look at Oregonians who find that this education fits them and tell them they're not worth it.
To follow up.
Certainly.
To be clear, I absolutely understand what you're saying, and I am very grateful that I had an opportunity through Pell Grants and through programs like this to be able to go to college when a lot of other people couldn't. But we have to look at people every day, mm-hmm. and have to look at students who not necessarily are taking French philosophy classes, but nursing students who cannot get into our community college programs because we don't have the money to fund the slots. I mean, students with four O's that cannot get into a nursing program. So we have to look at people every day and say, I'm sorry, I can't help you get there. But there is a small group of people that we are able to help. And I hope with the work that we're doing now and listening to you and working towards over the next decade, we can make some transformational change in how we invest in higher education. But to be clear, mm-hmm. I hope that you don't walk away thinking that we want to look at students and not treat them in an equitable manner. But the reality is we don't have excess funds, and we don't have excess funds more than we didn't have excess funds last year and the year before and the year before that.
Thank you. I understand that, and I believe that you all are in a very tough philosophical position. Absolutely.
Thank you, Gina. Oh, Representative Springer. Sorry.
I just cued in. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I'm kind of sitting here thinking of, she disappeared. She probably went to class. The nursing student that we, there she is. You should be in class, shouldn't you? Very good. So I'm thinking of her that tried to get into the community college nursing program and couldn't. If she had applied for an opportunity grant and if she had qualified, we would have been happy to support her in being a nursing student at a community college. She couldn't get in, and there's lots of people that can't get in because it's very tough. And so then here's another alternative for her. Her goal's the same. Her situation's the same. And then I'm thinking, wow, but because she's chose Institution A and can't get into Institution B or that doesn't work, she's no longer eligible.
Right.
That just strikes me as I'm sitting here listening to this, that just strikes me as not right.
Perplexing situation. Thank you. Appreciate it. Leah Davidson.
It's okay. We can proceed because I have a question for us about this issue.
OK. Okay.
Okay.
Committee.
So you can call up the next person if you like.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Hmm? Leah Davidson, please.
Question.
So here's my question. Do we have in this account, which may be named a trust fund, a pot of money that is there in reserve for the expressed purpose, almost never used, fortunately, because schools are very rarely failing and students very rarely need to access it, that could be leveraged to provide support for people from those institutions? I don't expect it. Thumbs up, thumbs down right now, but we could think about this.
I think you have to figure out the financing aspect mm-hmm. of that and see how those are privately held and if the private equity groups are holding them and how that's leveraged. That's a great idea.
Mm-hmm. Good thought, Representative.
Yeah. Maybe we can have Anna look into the...
Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the subcommittee. My name is Leah Noble Davidson. I go to the Art Institute of Portland. I'm in the Design Research Program. And it's a really interesting program, and I love it. I feel like I was actually born to do this. At first, growing up, I went to a bunch of different community colleges and just kept acquiring all my prerequisites and going through life hoping that one day I would figure out what it was that I wanted to do. And so I started thinking about going to art school, and it just seemed ridiculous and silly. By chance, I ended up going into the Art Institute of Portland, and I found this design research program. Why I like it is because it actually helps design, the field of design. Half of my degree is anthropology and cultural ethnography and watching people, and the other part is working with designers to create something actually meaningful instead of marketing. The reason why I'm telling you about my degree is because the Art Institute of Portland is the only place that offers such a degree. There isn't one offered by any of the other schools in Oregon. As a matter of fact, there's no four-year degree offered in design research anywhere all up and down the West Coast. You can get an anthropology degree with some business, but you don't really learn design. And you can get a design degree and then try and go back and do your own research side, and you can get a couple different ones. But something like my degree isn't offered, and I really appreciate that at the Art Institute. Another reason why I really appreciate the school that I go to is that I'm a mom. I'm a single mom. I'm also a 4.0 student. And because I go to the Art Institute, I've had the honor of being able to work in the field that I'm going to school for now because I get to meet industry professionals. And so I have an internship and also a contract position doing design research already, even though I graduate in June. The structure of the Art Institute is different than ones that universities might afford me, because I can work and then go to school and 4-hour blocks and do it at night and meet other people that are in the industry. It's just a completely different atmosphere with small classes where the professors really have the opportunity to change the lives just in introducing someone to somebody else in a way that I never experienced going to big schools. So finally, I just want to say that it's my understanding that diversity breeds success in individuals, in communities, in anything. And closing off money that goes to students, regardless of whether they pick a for-profit or a community school, it also sort of closes off programs that are so small that they couldn't be developed by big, giant schools. And my program would never exist if I didn't go to a private for-profit school. And that really hurts because it's something I really want to do with my entire life. And, So allowing students that attend for-profit schools to benefit from the Oregon Opportunity Grant is about more than money. It's about the lives of the students, and it's about students like me. It's in your own best interest to support me. So I just want to go out and do my job and be a good Oregonian. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for you? Thanks so much. Appreciate your time. And we have one more. Wayne Matuluk. Matuluk.
Matulich, maybe?
Matulich.
Wayne from ITT.
Never enough light. Co-Chair Johnson.
Co-Chair Dembrough.
Thank you very much for allowing us to be here this afternoon and speak. My name is Wayne Matuluk. I am the college director at ITT Tech, the one that's available for people to come in, and I'm very proud of the testimony that Erica gave earlier. I can only remember Tuesday talking to them and say, hey, time out, we have finals today. So I really appreciate them having put some thoughts together. I would like to speak in favor of the Oregon Opportunity Grant also, along with Gina. A lot of you have seen me before this group in over the last 5 years. And we've invited some of you into our schools and seen our students and sat in our classes and met our instructors. And we've toured other private career colleges. As president of the Northwest Career Colleges Federation, I've helped sponsor some tours around. And one of the things that always closes one of those visits is either a surprise or an agreement that the value of the system, the value of the students, the quality of the education, their enthusiasm for being part of the economy is always very, very high. I usually get comments of yes, that you know they certainly are deserving of state funding. And it, as Gina mentioned, it usually comes down to funding. So I'd like to sort of look at it as two steps. And we would love to bring more students, but I want to just talk a little bit about the demographic of the type of person, and maybe answer some of the questions as to, well, why do these people, why are they going to a private career college? Why aren't they going to a public school? And we have similar situations where we have single moms that need a pointed, focused program that they can get into and out of in a good period of time. They need flexible hours where perhaps with a family, you know, you heard a family living in a single-story ranch house with seven people in the house. You know, mom's needed in the house, so she needs a predictable schedule. We actually have a lot of traditional college grads as our students that have associate's and bachelor's degrees from around the country and throughout Oregon. But they're in fields that aren't focused on good careers. And now they come to a private career college and say, hey, I have a good degree. It could be with a community college. It could be with Oregon State. And they come to ITT. We focus on very few areas, all sort of in the high top 10 future type jobs like electronics, computer network systems, and now our RN nursing program. They come there and they want to sort of retool themselves into a new field and take advantage of the education they have and then apply it to our program. We have veterans. About, depending on sort of the ebb and flow of things, 15% to 17% of our students are veterans. And when I talk to these veterans, the reason a lot of them are veterans is because school wasn't in plan A when they got out of high school. They didn't get along with the system. So they joined the Army. They came out 6 years later, and our average student is around 26, 27 years old. They can't just jump back into a traditional education environment. And we give them a lot of one-on-one help. They like to learn the way they like to learn, and that's hands-on, a kinesthetic approach. And that's what private career colleges do. We talk about theory, we go next door and we put them in a lab and let them work hands-on, and they learn a lot better. And these people come out very, very valuable with good jobs, good-paying jobs. But if they were thrown into the, not thrown in, but only allowed to go through the traditional education system, they probably would have the same problems they had, and the dropout rate would be much, much higher. And our students go from Klamath Falls all the way to Astoria, and they all come for their own reason. And I ask them, every single student that comes in my door, why are you here? I never get the answer, I am here for the education. It's always, I need a job. I will be the first member in my family to ever graduate college. And we know we're spawning success from there because we know the sons and daughters of college graduates pursue college. So we're sort of changing the family tree in the future, and that's sort of what keeps us all going in our industry. We talked a little bit about the grant earlier and who contributes. And even in the grant write-up, there's contributions at every level. The student has contributions to their education. The student's family has contributions, and we certainly would agree that Erica's family is making huge contributions to her education. The federal government, and we have that through Stafford loans and Pell grants, and the state has an obligation to these students because these students are going to graduate and be very, very good contributors to the local economy, the tax structure of the state, and support the state. In the case of the private career college students, the one piece that is missing there is the state support. And I would really like to sort of be succinct and get to the point here is I think we're looking at two things here. The first thing we're looking at, I don't think anybody in the room will argue, even the first gentleman that spoke earlier, is that the students from private career colleges certainly as citizens of Oregon should participate and are due the same type of participation. The second question is a funding piece. But I think the first question we have to ask is should we include these students that are working hard and are going to be future contributors? And I think we will all agree the answer is yes. And then from that point, then it becomes a funding issue. And it may not be at the same level, but I think as Gina mentioned, there has to be equity across all systems, across all sectors of education, and treat all the citizens of Oregon the same way. You know, we do the same thing with highways. We don't limit who uses our highways. We don't limit who uses all of our public attributes or entities that we have. So, much to the same part, I don't think we should put aside the graduates or students of a private career college. So let's make that first decision, and then from there, see how much the state can support. So thank you for your support. Thank you for your consideration. Thank you for your service, too. And you know, I could answer some of those questions you had earlier on our program, too.
Representative Lindsay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I failed to ask my most popular question. And that is, what is the retention rate and graduation rate of for-profit schools, especially compared to public schools?
I can't speak for all of them. I could speak for ITT. And retention rate, it depends how you define retention rate. I think the sort of traditional look at retention rate, if you want to compare apples to apples, is how many students make it beyond the first academic year, which is sort of unfair because every three quarters is an academic year. So if you looked at it at that point, it would be in excess of 60%. And I think probably close to 70%. A graduation rate and completion rate, you continue to have attrition, and it's not for any one reason. There's many, many reasons that students attrit. But the final, from the number of students that come in the front door and sign up and graduate, is in excess of 50%. And And then from there, we don't consider that the milestone. We consider the milestone of what percent of our students are actually employed and validated, almost third party, in the field of study that they were preparing for. And that is 80%, and in some schools even higher.
Representative Harker.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. We're swamped with things. I'm always playing catch-up, and I'm playing catch-up right now. The background on this bill says that unlike federal student aid, Oregon Opportunity Grants can only be applied, Chicago Sun-Times article recently says that the industry is this is a reference to the intense lobbying by the for-profit colleges going on at the federal level to attempt to stop the new regulations that would withhold federal education loans and grants from those same schools. The organization spent $6 million on lobbyists in 2010 election, and while these schools educate 10% of all college students, they get 25% of all the Pell Grants. For-profit school students make up 44% of the federal student loan defaults. What do other states do, and what other comments might you have about that? I'm reading out of the Chicago Sun-Times, didn't know it before about 45 seconds ago. Okay.
Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Tembro, Representative Harker. Again, I could sort of speak for myself, and I think Gina, her number of around 60% of our students are Pell eligible, would speak to the sort of the economic level of the student. A lot of them are very, very poor. I think the definition of default, I suppose, would have to be clear to I think from my perspective, what do we do to make sure the student is employed, employable, and what do we do to prepare them to pay back student loans is the important thing from a local perspective. And we counsel our students as they go through financial aid, their responsibility to pay back the loan, their responsibilities through school, and the timing of that. I can't really speak to the national side. I could speak to how we deal with that. The important thing is that they come out at a high percentage of getting good jobs where they can pay back those loans.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I follow up?
Please.
I agree. Reading another sentence, too many students are paying 20 to 30 grand for associate's degrees but not landing jobs.
That could be true in some schools. I'm not an industry expert. I can speak in our case. Mm-hmm. And the programs that we offer at ITT Technical Institute are those programs that are in high demand and pay good wages. We're talking about computer programming, computer network systems, how to hook up companies and infrastructure, electronics, which is the foundation of all technology, and now registered nursing, which we have all agreed, I think, over listening today, that is just highly, highly underserved in the state of Oregon. And I might answer a couple earlier questions on the nursing part. OCNE is...
If possible, I'd like you to try to wrap up. We do have lots to get to.
Unless you have any other questions, I certainly support it and
appreciate
for your consideration.
Yeah, appreciate your testimony.
Okay.
John Wyckoff would like to weigh in on this issue, I think, too. I'd like to let John have that opportunity from the community colleges.
Chair Johnson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Wyckoff. I'm the legislative director of the Oregon Community College Association, representing Oregon's 17 community colleges. And I wanted to respond to one of the things that had been said today. And for the record, our association is does oppose this legislation. But I did want to just talk about one specific piece in the way that the opportunity grant is currently allocated. And to illustrate that, I want to read from a government accountability office report. It's the investigative arm of the U.S. Congress. It's a nonpartisan part of the U.S. Congress. And they did a report in 2010 looking at the for-profit college industry that was really quite critical of a lot of the practices of the for-profit industry. And I'm not going to get as far into that because, I mean, to be fair, what this report did is they sent out investigators to pose as students and apply at many for-profit colleges. None of the investigators came to Oregon, so I want to be clear about that. Each state, I believe, has different regulatory schemes for, and I mean scheme in the true sense, not in the mean judgmental sense, for for-profit colleges. And it may be that Oregon has tougher regulations than other states. I quite honestly don't know. So I just want to be clear that this report dealt with investigators going to in other states, but many that were national companies that are represented here today. I just want to read the first two paragraphs of the report, and what it gets to also is where I think our colleges get concerned that in the way that the opportunity grant is currently allocated, we would get overwhelmed in the process. So that would be our major concern. Undercover tests at 15 for-profit colleges found that 4 colleges encouraged fraudulent practices and that all 15 made deceptive or otherwise questionable statements to GAO's undercover applicants. 4 undercover applicants were encouraged by college personnel to falsify their financial aid forms to qualify for federal aid. For example, one admissions representative told an applicant to fraudulently remove $250,000 in savings. Other college representatives exaggerated undercover applicants' potential salary after graduation and failed to provide clear information about the college's program duration, costs, or graduation rate, despite federal regulations requiring them to do so. Now, again, I want to be clear. This investigation didn't hit Oregon, but the point is that we get concerned about is there is an awful lot of pressure to bring in students with financial aid into these colleges, and where there is an awful lot of investment put into sort of admissions counselors to get folks in the door. That in and of itself isn't a bad thing, and I'm not saying it is, but where we get concerned, I just want to read the second paragraph of the report. In addition, GAO's 4 fictitious prospective students received numerous repetitive calls from for-profit colleges attempting to recruit the students when they registered with websites designed to link for-profit colleges with prospective students. Once registered, GAO's prospective students began receiving calls within 5 minutes. One fictitious prospective student received more than 180 phone calls in a month. Calls were received at all hours of the day as late as 11 p.m. And then apparently they have audio clips of the calls. I'll send the report to the committee. Our concern with that is not that they're being very aggressive. That's great that they have the resources to do so. The concern is that the way we currently allocate the opportunity grant, because we're short of funding, is we set an early deadline for the opportunity grant applications with first come, first serve. It isn't really very equitable the way it's currently done. Currently, community colleges are turning away over half of eligible students. Well, we're not turning them away, but the over half of students eligible for the opportunity grant attending community colleges don't receive the grant because we don't have enough funding and because of that early deadline. Our students tend to apply throughout the entire year. I like to remind folks that the academic calendar doesn't necessarily match the layoff calendar. And so if you're laid off in May and the deadline is in February, this program isn't currently serving our students very well. OUS is currently serving, according to the numbers I recently got from the Student Assistance Commission, which I will also get to the committee, nearly all of their students. Now, to be fair, the Oregon University System is also using some of their tuition dollars to supplement their part of the grant. So they are actually paying for it out of tuition dollars. And the private nonprofit institutions are reaching most of their students too. Our concern, and it gets to what was in the GAO report, is that there is an awful lot of resources in the for-profit industry to get students registered, to get them connected with financial aid, and for us the concern would be if it's first come, first serve, our 50% of students served is going to go even lower because we simply can't compete with the resources that are in play to get students who are financially eligible into the pipeline. And so one suggestion I might make is, should the committee want to move forward with this, is perhaps creating a second program. And that this is something that we've been talking to the Opportunity Grant or to the Student Assistance Commission about anyway, and that you might want to look at sort of bifurcating the two-year and the four-year because we have different enrollment patterns and our students enroll differently. And I would ask if the committee is going to move forward with this proposal, to look at making it a separate program so that where the public sector, we just simply don't have the resources to put as many folks in the field to do that as the for-profit schools do, and we would be concerned that we would get overwhelmed. And with that, I will close.
We have time for one quick question, maybe. Well, at least one from Representative Lindsay.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I'd love to see these investigators do the exact same investigation on public schools. So I guarantee that we all know that public schools don't all have clean hands either. But the question is isn't the return on investment worth it? 80% plus job fulfillment or job placement compared to our public schools? And these 80% people are employed paying taxes. Isn't the return on investment worth it?
Chair Johnson, Representative Lindsay. There are a couple things. The first is that I think in this report, which I'll send to you, placement rates are one of the issues I'm concerned about, whether the placement rates are accurate. The second is, I'm not sure I'm the right person to answer the question of whether I think it's your all's job to decide whether the investment's worth it. I'm not here to tell you that I don't think the for-profit schools play a legitimate role. We're not saying they don't play a legitimate role. What we're saying is we're concerned in the context of financial aid that this legislation may not have appropriate sideboards in the current program.
And Representative Hoyle.
Thank you. So just to reiterate, the GAO report did not look at any Oregon schools.
No, but it did look at schools. It looked at schools that were national, publicly traded schools that are represented in Oregon. But I do want to be clear. Again, each state, I believe, has a different regulatory scheme for, and that's just not an area in which I am expert at what the regulatory schemes are in each state for the for-profit schools. But that was the main thrust of the report. It then got into the amount of activity in admissions, and that's where our real concern is in the area of admissions and where we would get overwhelmed in the context of the Opportunity Grant.
So, I certainly understand your argument about getting overwhelmed with having more students and not having enough money for the current students. We have absolutely understand that issue. And I have, in other states, had direct experience in working with students who had extremely bad experiences with some predatory practices with for-profit colleges. But I have to tell you, having gone to visited a number of the for-profit colleges here, I haven't seen that same kind of behavior. And I also think we have some different standards. So, to be clear, I think it's really important that we don't cast aspersions when there isn't direct proof that there is any kind of anything going on. Although I do appreciate your testimony. Just wanted to put that on the record.
I believe Representative Harker has. Oh, he's good? Okay. Thank you, John. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
We have two students I know who wanted to speak today who didn't get their names on the list, and if you wanted to come up right now, that would be great, and we'll give you 3 minutes. Maximum, is that correct? If your point's already been made, that's perfectly fine. We don't have to plow new ground or old ground, I guess.
I'm sorry, our student is a panel.
Okay, we're good on. Okay, nobody else here that wants to talk to 2027. Then is that correct? And that is great. And with that, we will go ahead and
thank you.
Gavel our hearing on that bill to a close.
Mr. Chair, but while we're in transition, you know, if I could say, this is a big subject, the subject of for-profit schools and the role in that, and the contributions that they have to offer to higher education in general. One of the things that we're looking at as a state, you all may not be aware of this, is creating a new way, a new kind of overarching commission that will look at all of higher education, including the universities, the community colleges, the you know, the private colleges, everyone, and you know, be talking about some of the things that we're talking about here, because we need to look at the different contributions that the different sectors can make. We've kind of opened a bit of a can of worms here with this subject, and these are issues that are going to come back to us, and you know, I'm hoping that we'll be looking into further as a committee.
And I would just add on the same topic that, you know, the notion of making a profit to me is not offensive. I certainly prefer the word private career colleges, you know, and I recognize that if a business is profitable, it's got to be doing something right, because otherwise it wouldn't be there. So I'm just speaking for myself. But with that, we'll open up a public hearing on House bills. We're going to have a panel that's going to come testify on behalf of these. We're going to open up a public hearing on House bills 2021, 2022, 2024, 2025, and 2026. So if all of those people would assemble themselves, Gina, would you be able to come forward and lead this? Is that what we're doing?
2021.
Signed up for the panel.
You're on.
Okay. I'm so sorry, sir. Mm-hmm. Are we testifying on we're on the bills? It's not the panel presentation, correct?
My understanding is that there was a panel for...
Are we incorrect? We can do it differently.
21. Or perhaps we should move on to Teresa Green, and we can start there with the
school bills. Okay. Teresa Green, then. Let's do it that way. I'm sorry.
Chair Johnson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Autumn Wilburn, Legislative Director for the Oregon Department of Education. With me today, I have Teresa Green, also from the department, to speak to you about our series of private career school bills. It became clear when speaking with the co-chairs that an overview about private career schools and how it is that they fit into the Department of Education was necessary. So that's the place at which we're going to begin today, and then we'd be happy to speak to you about our series of bills.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Johnson, members of the committee. Thank you for your time today. For the record, my name is Teresa Green. I'm a director at the Oregon Department of Education, and part of my responsibilities include oversight for the Private Career School Licensing Program. I'm going to give you a brief overview of what this program encompasses so that you have some background and context for the bills that hopefully we can present today and why they're important. After the overview and any questions you have, then hopefully we'll be able to move on to presenting those bills. You have a handout of the slides so that you can follow along with this. So, what are private career schools? Private career schools are post-secondary, non-degree granting, privately owned institutions that offer career or vocational training. These institutions are mainly for-profit organizations, although we have had a couple of schools that were incorporated as nonprofits. Most often these schools are corporations, sole proprietorships operating under a DBA, or are operated as a function within a larger business context, meaning that the school is not a legal entity unto itself. The types of training that are offered at these schools prepare students for a diverse range of occupations. This is just a partial list of the types of schools that are licensed with our agency. We have a legal definition in statute that defines what types of entities and under what conditions training programs must be licensed to operate. Career school or school means any private, proprietary, professional, technical, home study, correspondence, business, or other school institution, organization, or person that offers any instruction or training for the purpose or purported purpose of instructing, training, or preparing persons for any profession. So any organization or person who offers training in any form and advertises that a person can get a job after completing the training being offered is subject to licensure. Today we have 257 current active licensees. This number fluctuates quite a bit over time, ranging anywhere from 250 up to 307. Schools close for a variety of reasons, but we always have a steady influx of new school applications to review. Last year we licensed 28 new schools. This year we've granted 3 new licenses so far. We have another 5 under review, and we've received 47 requests for a new school application. So we expect to see a significant number of those returned in the coming months. More than 30,000 students are enrolled in these schools each year, and enrollment numbers jumped by 14.5% during 2010 over the previous year. Any downturn in the economy causes people to seek retraining opportunities, and we believe the increase in the workforce investment funds for retraining was a factor in this enrollment jump. These schools employ over 3,500 teachers and approximately another 900 in other administrative and support positions. Program length in the career schools can range from just 20 hours for some insurance agent programs to 2,300 hours in our cosmetology schools. Each year, between 17,000 and 18,000 students graduate with an educational credential from these schools. When the private career school statutes were initially formulated, the legislature made it clear right in the statute what the purpose of the regulation should be, and we appreciate having this guidance and strive to always keep it in mind when we seek to improve our relationship with and service to the schools. The legislature declared that career schools are a valuable part of the education system in Oregon as they increase the options for post-secondary education available to students. The legislature also made it clear that career schools contribute to the social and economic progress of the state. They do this in at least 2 primary ways. One, they are themselves employers, and as was noted on a previous slide, provide thousands of needed jobs for Oregonians. And then 2, they produce the trained and skilled workers that are included in that middle 40% of the 40-40-20 vision plan. So they do double duty and are a valuable part of Oregon's economy. Regulation under this chapter achieves 3 main goals. 1, protection for students' investment of time, effort, and money. 2, to ensure that there are quality education options for Oregon students. And 3, to ensure the better welfare of not only the students, but the schools themselves and the citizens who are served by the graduates of these schools. These goals are achieved primarily through enforcement of a set of minimum standards that set the expectations for everything from quality of the instructional program to the business practices employed by the school. We also maintain and administer the Tuition Protection Fund for the protection of the students. The technical assistance we offer schools to meet these standards help keep the market competition fair and healthy, thereby promoting quality improvements in the schools. Our monitoring of compliance with applicable laws and ordinances helps ensure the students are educated in a safe and appropriate environment, and attention to the quality of the instructional program ensures that the graduates of our schools are ready to contribute their talents and skills to the citizenry in a safe and lawful manner. The minimum standards that I mentioned are articulated in ORS 345-325 and cover a variety of aspects of operation of a career school. Every school is required to address and maintain quality in each of these areas, and our administrative rules are formulated to provide guidance on how to achieve that quality. In the area of quality education, schools must provide instructional programs that are based on current market needs, that provide students with the knowledge, skills, and attitudes necessary to meet industry standards for the profession which they are training. They must employ qualified instructional staff, offer an educational credential at the successful completion of training, and offer a placement assistance component in their curriculum. In the area of fiscal responsibility, all schools must demonstrate financial viability and the ability to meet the obligations of the school, including refunds due to students who withdraw and their payments to the Tuition Protection Fund. In the area of public safety, they must provide and maintain safe facilities that are adequately configured to provide the instruction involved in their programs. In the area of consumer protection, schools must provide full disclosure to students, either directly or through their agents, regarding job market conditions, the scope and sequence of the training provided, tuition and other related costs of the instructional program, and other relevant information regarding the school. In the area of accountability, schools must maintain record-keeping systems according to a set of established expectations for the content and nature of those records, retention, disposal, and maintenance of confidentiality. In the area of ethics, schools are expected to employ persons of good character, as defined in statute and rule, adhere to sound and ethical business practices, prevent any form of discrimination, and comply with all applicable laws and ordinances, including the Uniform Trade Practices Act, as set forth in statute. Training and technical assistance in these areas, monitoring of compliance, complaint investigation and resolution, and enforcement and sanctioning are some of the activities performed by the staff at ODE in relation to these minimum standards. The statutes charge the superintendent of public instruction with the administration and enforcement of this program, including administration of the tuition protection fund. The State Board of Education is empowered to adopt rules to ensure that all entities offering career training become licensed and uphold the minimum standards outlined in statute. We work in partnership with an advisory committee provided for in statute and appointed by the superintendent, which consists of 11 members, 7 of whom must be representatives of career schools. The remaining 4 are public members, one of whom must be a graduate of a career school. The advisory committee meets at a minimum twice a year and more often as needed, such as when rules are being revised or legislation for the biennial session is being formulated or other projects are undertaken. The committee is staffed by department personnel and funded from the program's operating budget. The department currently has 2.5 permanent FTE dedicated to this program. This accounts for roughly 85% of our operating budget. The remaining 15% pays for travel costs to conduct our technical assistance activities and annual site visits, expenses of the advisory committee, and miscellaneous operating expenses. It's important to note here that the activities of the program staff are not just regulatory in nature. The staff performs all the usual regulatory functions found in a licensing program, but the majority of a program specialist time at the department is dedicated to providing targeted technical assistance to school owners and staff and to potential new school owners. I routinely get calls from people whose first question is, "I want to open a career school, and I was told I need to talk to you. What do I need to know?" And they have no concept of the scope of the question that they've just asked. We start with the rules and statutes, and there are many that private career schools must comply with, and it's overwhelming for the new school owners when they first start out. So we spend a lot of time with owners and staff explaining requirements and helping them formulate systems and procedures so they can maintain compliance with those requirements. We provide assistance and consultation on curriculum development, policy formulation, record-keeping systems, how to manage student grievance procedures, documentation of satisfactory student progress, program improvement strategies, the list goes on. And these are just a few of the topics that we're asked to provide insight and assistance with, and I can give you many examples of each. It's not easy to run a small business in today's economy, and it's a double challenge when that small business is in the business of providing quality educational services. Our technical assistance is continually sought after and is an important support in helping our schools to make the quality improvements necessary to successfully meet the challenges they encounter. We also manage the system of notification from the community colleges to the private sector when a new program is being considered by a community college, and we inform schools of the adverse impact process. We maintain a public database of information regarding programs offered in our schools, as well as a variety of informational tools on our website to help potential career school students find the schools that meet their needs. Keeping the goals of student protection and quality instruction in mind, we've been hard at work over the past 2 years creating a framework to help our schools reach that next level of quality that will keep the market strong and enable them to meet the multiple demands for accountability they're facing. In a general sense, our short-term goals encompass implementation of a variety of quality improvement strategies. This starts first and foremost with the implementation of a standard framework for a school's instructional design. This is more than just the curriculum. It includes the entire articulation of how teaching and learning occurs, from establishing the relevant industry standards, to identifying the technical competencies being taught, to the actual methods for delivery of instruction, all the way through to the appropriate assessment of the actual performance of the technical skills learned. It's a tight framework that ensures a student is taught what is needed to succeed in an industry, and that what is taught is actually what is assessed, and what is being assessed is what was actually taught. Our other activities include aligning reporting cycles with fiscal years so we have better data that's more easily interpretable, implementing higher standards for the printed materials students receive from a school with respect to policies, procedures, and program requirements and objectives, higher standards for how student records are maintained, and a new streamlined license renewal process that provides better performance data from the schools and cuts out redundant and confusing requirements. We expect to have full implementation of these efforts in about 2 years. Our long-term goals are equally ambitious. We work with several other state boards and agencies as licensed practitioners in a variety of fields for which our schools offer training. We need to have strong partnerships with these entities to ensure the training offered in the schools meets the needs of the industry and produces graduates who are well prepared to take and pass the state licensing exams. An example of this is our work with the Health Licensing Agency around the practical exam offered in our cosmetology schools. We've identified work we need to do to ensure this portion of the exam meets the high standards expected in the field. We can only do this together, and if we have good communication and a strong commitment to helping each other fulfill our statutory obligations. The Department of Education administers the portion of the Carl Perkins grant funds that are given to secondary schools to implement programs of study in career and technical education. Fostering partnerships between the secondary schools and business and industry is a part of the department's activities around CTE, and career schools are a natural choice to partner with the secondary school, contributing to a seamless transition from secondary to post-secondary study for those students interested in continuing their technical education after high school graduation. Already, some career schools have inquired about how to begin the groundwork for building these partnerships. And through our quality improvement efforts, we hope to act as facilitators for these conversations and partnerships over time. Online career education is a growing field and one that comes with its own unique set of challenges. As we see more and more schools moving towards offering this option, we need to establish quality standards that are specific to the online environment. A quality instructional program includes more than just a well-designed curriculum and assessment system. It must include teachers who not only are highly skilled in their field of technical expertise, but who also understand the principles and dynamics of adult education. We've begun an exploration of how to deliver technical assistance and resources to our schools and individuals who would like to be post-secondary career education teachers. Our goal is to develop a set of resources and trainings to meet this need. And finally, our advisory committee has discussed the possibilities of instituting an annual career school conference to provide training for all career school owners and staff in a wide variety of topics. Putting together a conference like this is a huge undertaking, and good planning well in advance of the event will be critical to its success. So that's our overview of the private career school licensing program. Before we move to presentation of the bills, does the committee have any questions?
Just a procedural question. How much longer in your presentation would you need for what you have prepared for us right now?
We have 5 bills to present, and if I went through the slides without any questions or breaks, would be about 10 minutes.
Okay. Could I just ask, we could deviate slightly from our schedule, committee, if we could just gavel this informational hearing closed just briefly, public hearing. We're going to open up quick work sessions on the 2 bills that we have on our agenda, try to deal with those while all of our members are here, and then we can resume back in with your portion of the hearing so we can finish with you. Is that okay?
Yes, thank you.
One of those convoluted days. We've got a lot of stuff on our plate. We're trying to get this stuff dealt with. So what I'm going to do then is gavel this hearing closed for temporarily on House Bills 2021, 2022, 2024, 2025, and 2026. And what I would like to do then is open up a work session on House Bill 3042. And I think our administrator will read that for us.
Just a moment, please.
Thank you for being patient.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
House Bill 3042 stipulates that tuition and or fees collected by the food and beverage career programs for courses relating to consumption and possession of alcohol is not considered sale of alcoholic beverage, allows educational programs to serve alcoholic beverages to students between 18 and 20 years of age, and allows for the possession or consumption of alcohol under the supervision of the educational provider for training purposes, permits property owners to allow persons between 18 and 20 years of age that possess and consume alcohol for educational purposes to remain on the property, becomes operative September 2nd, 2011, declares an emergency effective on passage. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2963. Is that the first one? No, 3042. I'm sorry. I move House Bill 3042 to the House Committee on Education with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Denbro moves House Bill 3042 to the House Committee on Education with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion regarding this bill? Any objection? Seeing none, so moved. I'd like to now open up a work session on House Bill 2963. And I would also, we have dash two amendments.
Did we close the work session?
I did.
Okay.
We have dash two amendments. Does everybody have a copy of that for House Bill 2963?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2963 directs the Joint Boards of Education to prepare a report on strategies for reducing higher education textbook costs and recommendations for implementing cost-reducing strategies, instructs the board to analyze potential cost savings for K-12 school districts, requires the boards to solicit student and faculty participation, reports to interim committee of the Legislative Assembly prior to October 1st, 2012, sunsets on convening 2013 legislative session, and declares an emergency effective on passage. House Bill 2963 also has the dash two amendment, which I believe we need to adopt.
Mr. Chair, I move that we adopt the dash two amendments to House Bill 2963, dated March 1st, 2011.
Representative Denbro has moved to adopt the dash two amendments to House Bill 2963. Is there any discussion?
I was just trying to, I'm trying to find the dash two. Oh, it's this one here. Okay.
There you go.
Mr. Chair, maybe I could explain.
That'd be helpful.
Yes. With these amendments came at the recommendation of some of the bookstore managers, both in their testimony and through communications. So we're adding three of the modalities that they would like to see explored as well: rentals, peer-to-peer textbook sales, that is student-to-student, and then use of print-on-demand services for book publishing. And then the other piece is to make sure that we have bookstore managers on the work group that works on this.
Okay. Any discussion on the amendments? Representative Harker?
No, let's go.
Any objection? Seeing none, the amendments are adopted. And now?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 2963 as amended to the House Committee on Education with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Denbro moves to the House Committee on Education, House Bill 2963 with a do-pass recommendation. Any discussion, Representative?
I do have a question. I see that it has a minimal fiscal impact. Can someone explain that a little bit further for me? I think that was put out by the LRO or LFO. If someone might be able to.
Sure. One moment, please. Representative Lindsay, the statement that was issued by fiscal describes it has a minimal expenditure impact, and it says, while this individual measure has a minimal fiscal impact, an agency may incur a net fiscal impact greater than this. I would need to seek more information to answer that for you properly.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, if I could just add to that. You know, I think usually when there's a minimal fiscal is put on it, it's assumed that this is something that can be handled within the agency's operations. depending on how far they decide to take it in terms of research or whatever, it may incur expenses, but that will be something that they won't...
Part of their normal operations.
They're part of their normal operations. I'll have to not do something else to do that.
Okay.
Any further discussion, comments, any concerns to the motion? Seeing none, so moved. With that, I'd like to close the work session on House Bill 2963, reopen our hearing on House Bills 2021, 2022, 2024, 2025, and 2026, and recognize that if any members need to leave at 3, we totally understand that. So with that, thank you so much for your patience, and please proceed.
Co-Chair Johnson, in the interest of time today, if we do need to cut it short and not go through all the bills, we understand, and we're happy to come back at some other date.
Thank you.
Okay, Co-Chair Johnson, committee members. Our first bill is House Bill 2021. This bill addresses fees. The annual licensing fee schedule is set forth in statute and is based on a school's annual gross tuition income. We have a set fee for initial licensing, and then every year thereafter, the annual fee corresponds with the school's annual gross tuition income according to the schedule. For example, the first tier of the schedule shows that schools with an annual gross tuition income of less than $15,000 pay an annual licensing fee of $450, and so on. We work not only with our advisory committee on program revisions, but also with other stakeholder groups like the Northwest Career Colleges Federation and the Oregon Cosmetology School Association. A fee increase has been discussed for well over a year with these groups, and all our stakeholders are in support of a fee increase. They recognize the value of the work we do and the technical assistance we provide, and are encouraged by the goals we've set and our willingness to help them achieve their goals as well, such as the annual Career School Conference. This program receives no general fund support, so we are dependent completely on this fee revenue for our operating budget. The proposed fee increase constitutes anywhere from a 28 to 35% increase, depending on which tier of the schedule a school might fall into. The fees have not been raised in over 10 years, and our operating costs have incrementally increased over time with inflation. If we are to continue to pursue the goals we've outlined and ensure quality in these schools, we need to raise our annual licensing fee. This bill also would move the fee schedule out of statute and into rule beginning with the 2013-15 biennium. Out of respect for my advisory committee, I do want to recognize that there were two strong voices at the table in opposition to that move, their fear being that it would be too easy then to raise fees on a whim without the scrutiny needed to justify the increase, which is certainly understandable. But I can tell you that the State Board of Education, who must approve all our rule changes, does not take the matter of increasing costs for the field lightly, and they have a process similar to the legislative process for vetting rule changes. All the analysis still has to be done, need still has to be demonstrated, public comment still has to be gathered and presented, and the advisory committee's role in providing input and recommendations is in no way diminished. We still have to appear before the board and justify our request, just as we are doing today. Our reason for wanting this change is to provide us the flexibility to respond to the need for changes in how we administer the program in a more timely manner when that need arises. From the perspective of both practicality and motivation, it's less resource-intensive to work with the rulemaking process than the legislative process, and we can initiate the change process when we need to rather than having to wait out the biennial legislative cycle. This bill also changes the status of our current late fee from a civil penalty that is credited to the general fund to an administrative fee, which can be appropriated to our operating budget, and establishes an administrative fee for investigative services when a school is found to be in serious violation of the law. Shall I continue?
Please.
Okay. House Bill 2022. This is primarily a housekeeping bill, as it changes the definition of suspension to be consistent with the way suspension is applied by other state agencies that issue licenses. Currently, our definition of suspension is that a school cannot advertise, recruit, or enroll new students. Our AAG has advised us that this is better described as probation with conditions and should be changed so we are consistent across all of state government. This bill changes the definition of suspension, so it truly is suspension or a cessation of all activity allowed by the license, and introduces the term probation with conditions to take the place of the sanction we were using as suspension. One of our stakeholders has asked for an amendment to this bill to clarify that when a school is placed on probation with conditions, there is no question as to whether the school is allowed to continue teaching the students currently enrolled. It is our intention that a school on probation is always allowed to continue to teach the students currently enrolled. If that were not the case, we would use suspension instead of probation. So that amendment will be forthcoming.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Springer.
Are you getting ready to move on to 2023?
Co-Chair Johnson, Representative Springer, that bill was pulled from the agenda.
Oh, that's right.
Presented
that's right.
Another time.
Well, before we move off this bill, I wanted to catch something. You mentioned the amendment and the language, and so I'm just confirming if it's the language I'm looking at here. It's on page... one, I guess. It says here in lines 17 through 20, a licensee, the new language, a licensee placed on probation may be subjected to conditions which may include prohibitions on advertising, recruiting students, or enrolling students. A licensee placed on probation may remain in operation and complete training of students enrolled. And then it goes down to 27 and 29, and I'm just trying to have this make sense with what I'm hearing from you. New language, a licensee whose license is suspended may not engage in any activities for which the license is required from the time the superintendent imposes the suspension until the time the suspension is removed. Is the amendment addressing that language?
Co-Chair Johnson, Representative Springer, no. The amendment was to strike that second sentence in that first part.
Okay. Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Please.
So, if a licensee is on probation with conditions, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
They would not be able to engage in any activities for which the license is required based on 27 through 29?
I don't. Co-Chair Johnson, Representative Springer, no, that would be suspension.
Okay.
The probation with conditions, one of the conditions may be that they cannot advertise, recruit, and enroll new students.
Okay.
The second sentence was confusing and implied that perhaps in addition to that condition, we would also not allow them to continue to teach their students, which is not the case.
Okay.
So for clarity, we can just strike it. It doesn't need to be there.
We follow up. So I think I'm understanding, and I think the amendment is going to address what that confusion right there. Okay, thank you.
Please.
Okay, House Bill 2024. This bill allows the department to recover costs related to the assessment and recovery of a civil penalty, such as AAG fees, from any civil penalty that is actually recovered. Assessing civil penalties is not a common occurrence for us, but at times it is necessary. When we do have to do it, it's a costly endeavor in terms of staff time and legal fees. We're not supported by general fund, yet any civil penalty recovered goes directly to the general fund, and we never see any portion of it. We've had a few cases, such as VCTI, which closed abruptly, leaving hundreds of students without refunds, and another computer training school in Portland that also closed without notice, where civil penalties were necessary and were quite large, well over $2 million in one instance. The legal fees incurred by the department to resolve these situations ran into thousands of dollars. Had we been able to recover any portion of those penalties, it would have been helpful for the department to be reimbursed for a portion of the recovered penalty to cover the cost of pursuing action against the school. In effect, the bill would allow the department to preserve the program operating budget to be spent on activities targeted towards quality improvement for all schools rather than on sanctioning the bad actors.
Mr. Chair, in the first section, there's a change in the civil penalty, is that right? Where a shall is changed to a may?
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us what the intent of that change is?
Co-Chair Johnson, Representative Denborough. I'm sorry, I don't have it in front of me.
Mr. Chair, if I may, I'm certainly not answering your question, Representative Denborough, but I caught that too, and it looks like it's semantics. It originally read, no civil penalty shall exceed $500 per violation. Now it says a civil penalty may not exceed $500 per violation. So I don't see it as a change in the amount of the violation. I see it somehow there's some, the legal eagles down in LC, I think, probably saw some need for a change in the may and the may not in the shall. I just wanted to get
a clarification on the record, because often, you know, shall is mandatory and may is permissive, and just to clarify what the intent is.
Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Denborough, I think that was something that Legislative Council did. It wasn't something that we asked for. Mm-hmm. So when they wrote it up, I think they just did that.
Right. So you intend to stay with the $500 ceiling?
Yes.
Thank you.
My question would be from towards the end of the bill. From each penalty recovered under this section, the superintendent may retain reasonable costs related to the investigation. Is there a way to quantify what we mean by reasonable? And what's in mind in that language, I guess?
Co-Chair Johnson, I think the intent there was, we've been involved in a couple of really big investigations that have taken hundreds and hundreds of staff hours, which is a detriment to the rest of the schools, since we are only funded by their licensing fees. So we wanted the ability to penalize a school that we have to spend that much time with, and I'm thinking that it's something that would have to be worked out in rule as to what the criteria were for that kind of a fee. It would need to be a threshold for maybe the seriousness of the violation or how many hours we've invested. I don't know at this time what those criteria would be.
Sure. And I guess I'd feel better if there were some sort of parameters or some sort of guidance there based on what reasonable would exactly mean from my perspective. Rep. Springer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This might be a bill that we want to chat with LC about, and at some point, if we have another work session, maybe have LC come up and chat with us, because I agree with Representative Denborough and his comments and questions regarding the shall and the may not, and then maybe this piece too, if that's something the committee's interested in.
Good counsel.
That would be useful. I mean, I suspect this is kind of boilerplate language for the other licensing boards as well, but it would be good to hear that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
House Bill 2025. This bill allows the State Board of Education to adopt rules of general governance for career schools. This is consistent with the authority of the State Board of Education over the K-12 sector of education, and will help us address a variety of situations we run into with schools that don't fit the traditional model of a school. For example, we've had 4 schools licensed with us that offered training for modeling and acting. This is not a traditional career, and the instruction offered is not exactly career training, yet without formal training, it's virtually impossible for folks to break into the field. Unfortunately, it's also an area prone to misrepresentation and unrealistic expectations on the part of students, who then turn around and seek resolution from the department. 3 of those 4 schools are no longer in operation, not because of any action on our part, but because of the difficult nature of the field. 2 of them shut their doors unexpectedly, and we ended up paying out of the tuition protection fund to reimburse the students who were left with no recourse. We are working closely with the last school to help them overcome the challenges inherent in their field, but we find our current role structure somewhat inadequate to address their needs. Another example is flight schools. Historically, flight schools were exempted from licensure because of FAA regulation. Yet, as was seen with the flight school that operated out of the Salem Airport, there are no consumer protections provided by the FAA. And when that school abruptly shut down, there were students who had paid as much as $70,000 for flight instruction who were left without any protected pathway to reimbursement. Last year, I had a flight school call me and want a license with us, so we sent them an application. He called back later to say there was no way he could complete the application because the model for flight instruction is so radically different than anything else that we deal with. We realized then that we would have to craft an entire set of rules specific to flight instruction in order to be able to license his school, and so we weren't able to accommodate him with a license. We do believe, however, that flight schools should be licensed as career schools.
Doesn't have a quorum issue.
The general governance provision will allow us to specify rules that are more narrow and focused and are targeted to special situations like these, and ensure that we are acting within the scope of our authority if we need to take regulatory action against a school. I can provide more examples of these situations if the committee would like to have them. As just a housekeeping note, this bill also changes the terminology of competency-based to proficiency-based with respect to our cosmetology schools. And this is just for the sake of clarity in light of our new instructional design framework. House Bill 2026. This bill makes it clear that we have the authority to consider the financial conditions of an owner of a school, in addition to the financial status of schools in general. We have many situations where the school is just a function of a larger business entity and is not an individual business entity in its own right. School owners find it very difficult to comply with our requirements that they send in financial information for only the school, because in these cases, the school expenses are part and parcel of the expenses of a larger business context. We require schools to be financially viable, but in many cases, the school, as a function of a larger business, is not a profit center that can stand alone. It's used by some businesses more as a recruitment tool for them to hire from, and they're not concerned with the profitability of just the school function. In these cases, we look at the financial health of the larger business context to determine whether the business can support the obligations of the school and ensure the protection of the student's financial investment. But this means we're looking at the financial condition of the owner, which we do not have clear authority to do. Some of our stakeholders who are in this position have asked that they be allowed to send in their corporate tax information in lieu of financial statements because of the difficulty and cost associated with trying to separate out that information. We agreed to that arrangement with a list of caveats and conditions because we don't want our schools to incur extra costs to meet our requirements if there's a viable alternative. However, we were uncomfortable that we do not have clear statutory direction to allow for us to assess financial information at the ownership level. So that concludes our presentation of the bills.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I do have a question about this one. Could you give us an example of the, of a business that would fall into this realm?
Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Dembrough, real estate agencies often will run a real estate school for the purpose of identifying agents they wish to hire, but the school function itself is not profitable for them, but they maintain it because it is profitable for their business in general. They identify the agents that they want that way.
Mm-hmm. Although, mm-hmm. So they charge tuition, but not as high as they might in order for it to be self-sustaining. Is that the idea?
Mm-hmm.
So what I guess you're painting a picture is a business that begins with one purpose in mind but then springs off into another subsection within that same business. Is that right? You might have a cooking school that then morphs into a beautician or something, and I'm just thinking off the top of my head, but is that kind of what you're talking about?
Co-Chair Johnson, sort of, yeah.
Okay.
A good example would be a tattoo studio that wants to train artists, then. So they've got clients who come in the front of the shop, and they've got students who come in the back of the shop. So they're running both businesses out of one business, and they don't incorporate that school as a separate business.
Mm-hmm. And just to follow up on that, so that the school may be self-supporting because the cost of instruction is not that substantial, but the business might go out of business, and then the school, essentially the students would have lost their investment and be at in jeopardy. Is that what this is trying to correct?
Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Dembrough, yes. If we can't look at the financial condition of the overall business which houses that school function, we don't know if that business were to go out of business, if that school would be able to continue. In most cases, it wouldn't. And when we have that situation, we ask for a lot of information to demonstrate, because they need to demonstrate financial viability. So we'll ask them for information that they have a very hard time providing for us, because they aren't set up that way in their accounting systems, and they're just not set up to separate those costs out.
Mm-hmm. And just to follow up, are schools like that paying into the tuition protection fund? So are students protected by their insurance, and you would oversee then any reimbursements that would be necessary?
Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Denborough, yes. They do, all schools have to pay into the tuition protection fund for the first 7 years of operation. How things go about getting paid out of that fund is a bit of a complicated process. It's not really an insurance fund. The schools are responsible to repay anything that we disperse from the fund on their behalf, although I don't know of a situation where we've ever recovered what we've disbursed.
Thank you, Teresa. Mm-hmm.
Sure. Thank you. Appreciate it. And apologize for vanishing committee, but life goes on.
You mean committees go on?
Yeah. We're going to hear from a panel today to talk about career schools in general. There was, I think, the misunderstanding that we had was that they were going to try to testify directly to these bills, but I'm thinking that there was a different purpose in mind. Is that correct? And we're finding that out right now. We don't have time to probably adequately allow views to be expressed today, so we'd certainly reschedule this time for the near future to bring people back, unless somebody is here from a long way away and they just really need and want to talk about the topic today, and if so, I can stay. And Representative Denborough can stay as well. So are there those who would like to just testify on behalf of career schools in general? And if so, we'll stay. Please come forward and tell us who you are. Gina.
Mr. Chair, there are three students here.
Okay.
That have one is just graduated and is ready to go to work.
Okay.
And could be called tomorrow to do that. So I would appreciate the opportunity for you guys to take a few moments and hear what they have to say about their selection.
If you would like to just call them forward as you think they're in the order of importance, that'd be great.
That'd be great, yes. If you all three would come on up, that would be great. Thank you for your consideration.
Oh, no, it's fine. We apologize. Really.
That's okay. Chris.
Chair Johnson and Chair Denborough, my name's Krista. I'm a student at ITT with Erica. We both started the same quarter together. I've given a copy of what I was going to talk about. I won't go through the whole thing. It's sort of long, my history. Very similar to Erica's differences. I went to Clark College in Vancouver for my prerequisites for nursing, and hoping that I could use those to either get into Clark, which I know was hard to get into, also PCC, Mount Hood, Clackamas Community College, and applied for those schools. I had a 3.36 GPA. Really wanted to get into any nursing school. Had been a firefighter and EMT, worked for FEMA, did all kinds of things, realized I wanted to be a nurse, and started my education process in 2006, taking the prerequisites, and finished them in 2008. 2007, I started applying for nursing schools. Continued to get denial letters, which every time you get a letter like that, it's heartbreaking. You know, I'm leaving a profession that I love because I want to do a little bit more for my community, and to be constantly told you're not good enough. Mm-hmm. I have A's and B's. I'm a single mom. I'm working two part-time jobs and getting A's and B's, and I was consistently told you're not good enough. And my last time I applied, my refusal letter I got from Clackamas Community College, I was giving up. I decided that maybe nursing wasn't... Sorry. Erica's fault. Maybe it wasn't going to be something I could do because I couldn't get into a school. And My mother-in-law's a nurse practitioner. Don't give up, don't give up, don't give up. One of her coworkers got into ITT's first cohort for the RN program, and she said, maybe you should go there, you know, look into it. Well, it's expensive. I don't know if I can afford that. Look into it. This is something you should do. You would be good at this job. You know, I went the route of the public schools. It didn't work out. ITT was my option. I went to an information meeting, really hesitant on it, not really sure. I've heard about these career colleges. You know, everybody's heard about them. Is this going to be something I can do? And I was really excited about the way they talked about the program and how they were going to put us into areas of high need for our clinical sites so that we could, when we got done, look at that place for a job. That we, they would know us as a student, they would know us as a student nurse, and we could apply for jobs in those places. When I got, I actually got a phone call from ITT. I took a HESI test, which is a placement test. I scored in the high 90s. A week after I got a phone call from IDT saying I'd been accepted, I got my final refusal letter from Clare College that said I wasn't qualified to take the HESI test, which was hard for me to hear when I had just done so well in it. But the day I got the call from IDT saying I'd been accepted into their nursing program, I'll never forget it. It was like, finally, I can move on. I can do what I want to do. I can help people. My plan is to finish school, get a job in the Portland area in one of the hospitals, and continue on to do forensic nursing, which is where you help victims of violent crimes. And that's the goal. And IDT has given me the ability to get to that point. Had I had the chance to get into a community college, I would have. I would have loved to have gone to PCC. I would have loved to have gone to Clackamas, but there wasn't room. And the only option I had was to go to a private college, pay a little bit more, and but get down and get out and get working and help the people in my community. So anyway, thank you for your time.
Can I just ask a question, Ms. Chair?
Sure.
Have you started your clinicals yet? And
summer quarter we start our clinicals.
Where will you be?
We don't know the site yet. The first cohort is starting in the spring, and we'll find out where they're going. I think it just depends on where there's available space, but we start out in long-term care facilities to do our first rotation for good patients.
Great. Thank you.
Chair Johnson. Representative Debro, thank you for your time. Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Robert Lacoste. I go to school with Ms. Davidson back there at the Art Institute of Portland. I'm currently studying industrial design. I'm actually a transplant from the Midwest, where I achieved a previous degree in English education from the University of Iowa. Unfortunately, once I graduated from there, which is a public university, there was no job waiting for me and no one to help me with an exit strategy in terms of finding employment in the field. It was sort of good luck, have a nice day, here's your bill. Now, when I got here, I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do. I knew I wanted to basically pursue my first interests, which were fabrication of various things, you know, from wood to metal to plastic products. And fishing around for schools, I found the Art Institute, and it was honestly the perfect fit. And I had never heard of industrial design before. No career counselor had ever told me about it. But it's one of these rather important professions that basically decide how things appear. Industrial designers design your tennis shoes. They design your sportswear, your bags. We work for companies such as Adidas, Nike, Columbia, so we are based very locally around Portland. We also do items for medical and military design. So everything from, you know, what is the control device that goes in the surgeon's hands that's going to be operating the robotic armature? What is that going to look like? Why does it look like that? Why is it a good fit? So it's a rather core industrial need that we fulfill. And honestly, shopping around the country, there are very few schools that offer industrial design. And of the ones that do, the Art Institute of Portland is actually one of the least expensive ones. In comparison, if you were to go down to Art Center in California, you would be looking at just shy of $150,000 for an unaccredited degree. There's a school in Cincinnati that offers a very well-articulated degree in the field. However, again, I mean, I would prefer to get out of the Midwest if given a choice. Our institute had also, as Ms. Davidson alluded to, gives you direct contact with professionals in the field, contact that is very useful when looking for a job. In addition, there is a person placed at the Art Institute to help you up to a year after your graduation to successfully achieve employment within your desired field. I know we have to keep this concise, so I'll open this up for questions if you have any.
Just one. So did you look to see if there are any public programs here in the state? And is that what pushed you to the Art Institute?
Actually, public programs, I understand that the University of Oregon in Eugene has something along the lines of an industrial design program. However, it's through their School of Architecture, and in general it's looked at as more of a master's program rather than a four-year degree. Also, to that effect, coming into the Art Institute with a prior degree, they were willing to waive all of my prerequisites and general education requirements. Mm-hmm. So essentially they were willing to thin down a four-year Bachelor's of Science program to, well, for me, a 2.5-year program.
Mm-hmm. And just follow up, and so you only had to pay for the credits?
Correct.
For 2.5 years worth?
Correct.
Great, thank you.
May I say one more thing?
Certainly.
I came sort of in the same situation. ITT looked at my prerequisite credits that I had, and the courses that were similar at ITT I don't have to take. So where it might have cost $54,000, it's only going to cost me $39,000. So they're willing to work with you with a lot of the programs if you already have stuff, so you're not having to double pay for things.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you. Co-Chair Johnson and Co-Chair Dembrough, thank you. My name is Chris.
You get the microphone there.
And I'm kind of in the same field like they are here. You know, I was I have a bachelor's degree from the University of Oregon 20 years ago now. So I had been working for most of that time until just recently in 2008. I was laid off permanently from my last job, so it was time for me to.
Good idea to just fully identify yourself. I think you said Chris, but
yeah,
you
Chris
last name.
Chris Simpson.
Perfect. That's all we needed.
You're
Thank
welcome. And so I had to, it was time to kind of look for a new field. I was driving for DHL, and they pretty much shut down operations here in the United States. So I was looking in a saturated market, and it was pretty tough to find anything, so especially at the pay that I was at already.
Mm-hmm.
So I chose to reinvent my life, and as I was looking for that, I had a background in healthcare, and looked at some of the fields out there and what would be a good job fit for myself. But like these other people had gone through, it's tough to get into a program, and then actually to get into that program, a lot of them are restricted, or it's very tough to get in, and then they want you to go to school, get good grades, and then if you're lucky enough to get chosen, you can get into that field. And truthfully, at the point where I'm at in my life, I don't have the time to go back to school and wait and hope that I get accepted into another program. So the opportunity at Concord College came up, and I was able to start in cohort one, so I know all about the cohorts, for respiratory therapy. And I have graduated now. And I'd just like to say that educational-wise, it was nice because they offered a third more hours in the clinical sites than the local community colleges have here, which for me and my learning purposes, it's nice to have hands-on learning, which if anybody, it's much better to do it than just read about it. And that's something that really steered me towards that, and it was nice. Also, the fact, and I know we've talked a lot about the costs and what it costs to go to these colleges, and they are more expensive. But the thing is if you start taking in the cost of having to spend a year to a year and a half just to get the prerequisites to get into a program, and then to get into that program, and the fact that the program that I'm in, or that I finished, was only 18 months, and if I had to get into the program that's at Mount Hood Community College, it would have been about 3 years. So now you're looking at, I'm done in 18 months, and the person in my position doing it at Mount Hood Community College has to wait another 18 months. I've got to jump on that job, and I have 18 months of earning in that job, which actually makes it sound like it's a better investment, in a sense, if you kind of understand where I'm going with that. And for me, it was nice because I got out, and our first cohort took all of our national boards, and all of us who graduated in that first group, we all passed our national board. So 100% of us have passed, and that's, I believe, about 40% above the national average. So it does say something about the level of education that we're getting there. And I also, within the first week that after I graduated, I was offered a job after interviewing. So that says something about the program and being able to go in and do what I need to do, which was get into school, learn a new skill, one that's marketable and in need, and get a job. And that's basically what we're doing when we get into the school. The end idea is we want a job, and that's where I'm at.
And no Oregon questions. Needs jobs. There's no question about
well,
that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yes.
Can I just ask you, Chris? And first of all, let me say you're going into a great field.
Thank you.
Respiratory techs do great, very important work.
It's very exciting.
Yeah. The difference in the amount of time that you were able to spend in Concord as opposed to what the Mount Hood program would have required, is that because of the prior learning that you had that was taken into account, or is there just more coursework in that program, or do you have a sense of what the difference is?
Basically, the Mount Hood, my understanding that the research that I did before I chose this was when I was looking, Concord hadn't started theirs right away, but they were looking to start that program, so I kind of got on their wait list, so to speak, that if it happens, call me type of thing. And then looking at Mount Hood, they only have one time where you can jump into the program if you're chosen. It's a very restricted entry program. Mm-hmm. Therefore, you have to show that you have grades in the courses that they like to see you have before you actually get into the courses that are meeting the needs for that particular field, which is respiratory therapy. So all those courses that you need beforehand are included in the Concord program. It's part of their general education before you get into the respiratory field. So they don't include those in their program, which is 2 years as opposed to 18 months. So I just like the fact that it's a more condensed, quicker school that is, you're spending all of your time going in and doing this, and then you have so much more time where you're spending actually doing the job in the clinical settings, which I liked also. Mm-hmm. And the fact that the instructors there had really taken upon themselves to take an interest in the student. And so when I was actually interviewing for those jobs and using my instructors' names to say, yeah, these are the people that I've worked with that know what I can do out in the field, it was amazing how many people out there in the hospitals and places that go, oh, I know that person. I've worked with them. And it was like, it was nice to know that working with those instructors and those people that I've worked with in school and in the clinical settings know the people that are hiring also. And it's like having that one extra leg up on the competition to get a job.
Well, thanks, you guys. Appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
And your patience.
And your patience. Yeah. Been very instructional, and we certainly have learned a lot today.
Thank you for your time.
Career school. So thank you, everybody that's here. With that, we're going to go ahead and close, I believe. Or
anything?
I think it's time to be done. We're going to close our hearings.
We've had enough. Thank you.
Yep. Thank you.
Close our hearings on House Bills 2021, 22, 24, 25, and 26. And we are adjourned.